For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Oklahomans are voting on five state questions on November 6th, and over the next few weeks, I want to get your thoughts on these measures. This week, we're looking at State Question 794, also known as Marcy's Law. It's a constitutional amendment from lawmakers guaranteeing certain rights to crime victims. These include opportunities for a victim to be heard during court proceedings, speedy resolution of a case, the right to talk to prosecutors, and the right to refuse interviews with defense attorneys. Ryan, what do you think of this measure?
I think it's well-intentioned. I think that crime victims and crime survivors are a very sympathetic group, and rightly so. And I suspect that at the ballot box, voters are going to see this as an effort to level a playing field. What I would ask folks is that when they're thinking about who's on that other side of the playing field here, is that this well-intentioned ballot measure says, you hear the rhetoric is that crime survivors should at least have the same rights as the people who perpetrate crimes. And often they'll go to the most heinous, rape or murder. But we have to remember that a bedrock principle in the United States criminal justice system is that you are innocent until proven guilty. You are presumed innocent. And so the individuals that we're talking about here are the accused. And so they are also innocent at this point. We've moved away from this idea that until a jury or a judge says you're guilty in the United States, and especially in Oklahoma, it's really at the point that your mugshot is taken, that society cast guilt upon you. Right now we have thousands and thousands and thousands of Oklahomans wasting away in county jails before they've ever been adjudicated of guilt whatsoever. The unintended consequences of this could possibly infringe upon the constitutional rights of the accused, but it could also create an enormous expenditure obligation on behalf of the courts that are already deeply, deeply underwater with their budgets. And, even aspects of the court, the Oklahoma County Public Defender's Office earlier this week condemned for asbestos, and they're moving their offices. We've got great disparities in our judicial system. This, I think, will just add to that.
Neva?
Well, I think the arguments that you just articulated, Ryan, are the ones that are out there on the opposing side. But overwhelmingly, I think what we're seeing is this particular type of law is one that is being really advocated across the country. We see six states this year that have it on the ballot. California passed it several years ago. Illinois, other states. So it seems at least at this point that that the argument of being something that is very popular with the voters. It's interesting to me that it really is the product of one single individual, a man who had a sister who was murdered, that really kind of launched this campaign nationally. He's funding it nationally. He's basically a 59-year-old billionaire person who made a lot of money and now has really focused his time and energy in Oklahoma. From the last ethics report I saw, the $900,100 that had been put forward in this campaign, $900,000 of it was his money. So this is when you look at it and kind of step back and take another component of the overarching look. This is a classic example of someone who sees and wants to have some change and is willing to put money behind it, personal money behind it, and make it a national movement. And I think that's what we're seeing here in Oklahoma this year.
When I see things like speedy resolution of a case and the right to refuse interviews with defense attorneys, that makes me question the fact that that's the whole system of what we're based on is a person who's charged with a crime has a chance to defend himself in court in a time.
And to confront their accusers.
Right.
And to make sure that all the facts bear out. And there is a subpoena exception in there where a criminal defendant could subpoena the testimony of a crime survivor or crime victim. But that seems to be an extraordinary step that is unnecessary in many instances. And I think that when we look at what the Oklahoma Constitution and Oklahoma laws already provide in terms of rights to crime survivors and crime victims, there are a large number of overlap with what we're seeing with Marcy's Law. And that's, it's this national movement, and I really think that the intent behind this is good intentions. And the individual out of California that's driving this, it came, they had to see at that time, the accused, he wasn't yet convicted, but the accused at a grocery store shortly after their sibling suffered a murder in California. And so that boilerplate language that we're seeing around the country, I think that it could create more problems in Oklahoma than it could actually solve.
And that's what I want to get to, is last week we talked about the optometrist, which would change the Constitution. If this is put in the Constitution, then that's it. You can't change it at all. And it's kind of boilerplate for every state's got its own Constitution.
And I think that will be the interesting thing in the closing weeks of this election season, is do we see some real give and take? Because when you look at kind of the way it stacks up right now, you have this overwhelming look at all of these folks that have come out supporting this, and you see very little kind of composite opposition to it that's really articulating some of the points that have just been mentioned. So I think until those points are raised in a wider context where people kind of pause and say, okay, is it just a victim's rights bill, or are there more issues here that not only are issues now but could be litigated down the road, which we saw in other states. I mean, there are one state, I think Montana passed it, and then it was overturned mm-hmm. because it was the single the argument being that there were multiple issues involved, and they in fact struck it down. So, you know, it does. I mean, one of the arguments that is being advanced, although I don't think it's been widespread, is the fact that this there could be some question down the road and some litigation. So, again, I think it probably speaks also to the issue with state questions, where I think most folks don't really start to key in and pay attention until very close to the end. They see the information out there. I will say that almost without exception, all of these state questions this year, we are seeing more opportunity for folks to get information on both sides of the mm-hmm. argument, on out there on websites and with information that's being distributed, which I think is very helpful.
There's only five.
I think the visceral reaction that folks have to this, this the very basic platform of the campaign for Marcy's Law is crime victims should have the same amount of rights as murderers. And I think that you're going to see wide bipartisan support for this. It's probably going to pass. I would just really encourage people to really consider the fact that these individuals that are going through the criminal justice system are accused. The people we have a lot of folks that are sitting in county jails right now, incarcerated, their freedoms taken away, their way from their families, their jobs, their communities. They haven't been found guilty of anything. And a bedrock principle of our criminal justice system that everyone ought to agree on is that you are innocent until proven guilty.
Very quickly, do you think this will be challenged if this goes?
I think that there's a potential for a challenge. I think that the biggest obstacle to implementation here is going to be funding. Where's the money going to come from to make all of these changes happen?
The two major candidates for governor took the stage Monday night for their first debate in preparation for the November general election. Democrat Drew Edmondson and Republican Kevin Stitt talked about a variety of topics, including education, health care, criminal justice. Neva, was there anything which stood out to you in this event?
Not a lot, and really I would characterize it more as an hour-long conversation than a debate. It really didn't elicit very much contrast. I think the questions were fairly obvious questions that come out at this point in a campaign. So I think with the forum and the debate, as I understand being the way it will be billed, coming up later in October, that may be both because of time, kind of the timing in the campaign, as well as maybe the format may lend to a little stronger exchange between the candidates. But basically, both were trying to carve out who they are versus who they see the opponent, kind of the biggest contrast points, both directions. I didn't see in my estimation, I think neither scored any big points, or were there any big surprises. But I do think that we may see that change as we get closer to the election.
Ryan,
I think Drew Edmondson did a really good job of contrasting himself with the current administration, and in doing so. Tied Stitt to what we've seen out of the Republican legislature, made him seem even out of step with that legislature and out of step with Governor Fallon. I mean, Kevin Stitt is talking about we need a more sustainable revenue stream, we need a more sustainable revenue model, but he's got absolutely no plan for that. He talks about the fact that we've got $1 billion in new revenue coming in during this next legislative session that we can invest in teachers and education. Well, $400 million of that, he said that he would have vetoed. And it's really not new revenue. It's revenue that we've replaced because other revenues have lagged in the past. And with Drew Edmondson, he's really doubled down on the idea that we have to have not only a we don't only have to protect these new revenues, but we have to add new revenue to that. And so it's interesting that he's walking into this election cycle not shying away from the idea of that we need some increased taxes, that the wealthier Oklahomans need to pay more of their fair share, that the oil and gas community needs to pay more of their fair share, and that until we do that, we're going to be in a fiscal crisis in the state of Oklahoma. And if the legislature won't do it, he would use his capital as governor, his political capital as governor, to take those questions direct to the people. For Kevin Stitt to be, to me, that's the more radical position to take in this. And you've got Kevin Stitt, who's saying that he's the outsider and not the politician, but a lot of his rhetoric sounds just canned right out of Republican talking points for the last two or three years. So it's very generic Republican candidate right now that Kevin Stitt's trying to become for the general election.
And there were some times when Chris Castile, the moderator for that debate, kind of had to hold Kevin Stitt and say, well, you need to answer the question now, which I a lot of credit I've heard from goes to Chris Castile for his keeping the politicians on task.
Yeah, I think there definitely seemed to be a very concerted effort on the part of the moderator to try to keep the focus on specifics. And let's face it, I mean, in these kind of dialogues and back and forth, we aren't going to see a lot of specifics most of the time. And when you do, I mean, the very points that Ryan makes, I mean, when you start talking about the willingness to raise taxes, go after, you know, certain industries, and do the things that that are kind of being outlined, I mean, it does start to separate the water and does kind of build for a political landscape that, you know, has some volatility to it. I mean, bottom line, I mean, when you still look at the overall makeup of this election season, you know, I think the Republicans still see themselves in a very good position to capture a lot of what Oklahomans see and feel and want, even though they have frustrations, they have issues, they know that there are big problems. I think to see this seismic shift another direction is going to take a lot more than what we've seen out of the campaigns on both sides so far.
I think in rural Oklahoma, we got a preview. I think Medicaid expansion is going to be the bulwark of the Edmondson campaign when you're talking about the closure of rural hospitals. Rural hospitals are on the ropes of closure right now. Kevin Stitt has said he does not believe in Medicaid expansion. He sees it as a handout that we're coddling sick Oklahomans that need access to health care. And I think Drew Edmondson sees it as a lifeline to these rural communities in particular to make sure that Oklahomans aren't left in the lurch without any sort of option for medical care for sometimes hundreds of miles around. In rural Oklahoma, that's going to be a real issue. And it's going to be, I don't think that Edmondson picks up rural Oklahoma with that. He's not going to win a lot of these rural counties, but I think he could potentially cut into Stitt's margin there enough that this could be a very competitive race and come down to Oklahoma.
And I think the question on that issue will be whether it is how it's framed versus how the public sees it. And if it's about raising taxes or not raising their taxes, I mean, I think historically what we've seen in Oklahoma is that there's not much of an appetite, you know, in general elections typically for folks to want to say that that's the direction that they want to go overall.
The Oklahoma Ethics Commission loses its battle in the state's highest court over more funding from lawmakers. The agency contends the legislature isn't funding it enough to perform its duties, but in a 5-4 ruling, the state Supreme Court finds the commission isn't unique in regard to other state agencies and must follow budgetary guidelines like everyone else. Ryan, did this surprise you?
Well, yeah, I think that it was a political question to begin with, and you know, courts just typically don't want to weigh in on matters that involve contest between individual branches of government. I mean, they're going to step in and protect separation of powers, but the Ethics Commission is its own constitutional entity, and what they're saying is that they are subject to the same budgetary laws as every other agency out there, constitutional or not. I think if the legislature came in and zeroed them out, you know, that may be a violation of the separation of powers clause in our state constitution. But as it is, you know, the court, and we mentioned this back whenever the lawsuit was originally filed, was that the court was going to have to say, you know, what are the specific particular constitutional mandates of the Ethics Commission, and can they get this done with this amount of funding? It doesn't matter whether they can get it done great, or if they can, you know, go over and above or provide all these different
services.
Did they
give them something?
But can they give them something? Yeah. And, you know, it was pretty clear to everybody that was looking at this that the legislature had an axe to grind with the Ethics Commission. Not only did they cut their budget, or not only did they give them a small fraction of what they'd requested, they took money out of their own revolving fund to pay for that budget, so that the maintenance that the Ethics Commission has to be able to tap into that revolving fund for one-time infrastructure expenditures, whatever, that's just gone. They took that money out of there. And so it was retribution. Now, the court will operate oftentimes in a legal fiction and pretend that these things don't happen, or acknowledge them but not allow them to go into their consideration.
Right. So, or take it off the facts.
Take it off the facts and say, we're not going to read into their motives here.
And that's what the state basically argued, was that all the other agencies have taken cuts. So, you know, you have to do.
And I think Ryan's right. This is a political football. I mean, both the commission and the legislature have sparred back and forth. I mean, you've had the pro tem call the agency a rogue agency. you've had the chairman of the commission basically say that he's appalled because, you know, all they are mad about the fact that we've kind of honed in and knuckled down on them, and that they don't like that kind of scrutiny. And somewhere in between is the real mix in this deal, and I think the public wants the Ethics Commission. I think the fact that we have kind of real-time access now to information in terms of who is giving to campaigns, how the campaigns are spending their money, who are the registered lobbyists, who are they representing? I mean, on and on. I mean, those things are clearly there in a fashion that much better than we've ever seen before. But the notion that you can, as an agency, whatever the makeup, just go and go to war with the legislature when they have the purse strings, I mean, is a fairly foolish idea. I mean, they have $700,000. They wanted $2.5. That's a pretty big $2.5 million. That's a pretty big gap right there in terms of what they think they need to operate their budget. So hopefully in the future there can be some kind of toning down and better better working atmosphere between the Ethics Commission and the legislature, because both of them are going to be around. They need to find a better way to coexist.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of money. They're saying, well, we need $2.5 million. They only got $700 million. The education, the Department of Corrections, they all ask for,
I think
what DOC asked for, $2 billion in the past.
Sure.
And they got that.
And I think then the question is, I mean, where is the expansion? Is it necessary? What's really the motivation behind it? And those are a lot of the questions that I think will continue to come up as they have to come in and talk about their budget in the upcoming session and explain what they want to do in the future.
Well, and I think that the legislature fully funding the Ethics Commission and not playing these games, it's important for the legislature. If people want to have confidence that their legislature is open and transparent, that we're doing everything we can to disincentivize corruption and catch it whenever it happens, then you need to have a fully functional, very robust Ethics Commission that can operate as this neutral, independent party out there. The more that that the public can have a sense that this is a fully functioning operational agency, I think that it lends itself to the legitimacy of the legislature.
Well, staying on the Ethics Commission, the agency is now facing a lawsuit from the Institute for Justice out of Arlington, Virginia, over the commission's rules on gifts. The Institute says the strict rules to give gifts of $10 or less are unconstitutional and restrict free speech. Neva, this just seems to be more bad news for commissioners.
Well, again, I think where's the give and take in this? I mean, we've gone to extremes. I mean, we're into this, let's don't give any gift. We can't give a $10 book. We can't give a $10, about $15 box of candy. We can't do these things. And if we do them, the rules are we can do them one time, a year. And there's, again, it's this give and take of where the boundaries. I mean, no one wants to see corruption outright, an attempt to kind of wholesale buy folks at the legislature. The flip side of that is I think that we have a legislature and we have an environment now where folks pretty well police themselves. You have professional lobbyists, professional associations and their executive directors and others who are out there on a regular basis dealing with the legislature, and they know who the bad actors are, and you know, and they get caught. I mean, so I think that the notion that somehow we're just going to squeeze down and become almost ridiculous in terms of what someone can do, I think those things are the things that need to be looked at. And this $10 gift, the book, I think, is a classic illustration.
Well, it was $18. It was,
oh, you know,
$18. That $8, Neva.
Okay, that $8 really threw it over.
That gets you a vote.
Yeah, well, that changes
well,
my mind.
It was an $18 book, yeah. But the $10 limit. So
yeah, right,
so they
right,
couldn't
right,
give an $18 gift
right,
because there's
right,
a $10
and,
limit.
But
and,
could they have gotten a discounted book? Could the $18 book have been discounted
that been
to $10?
In-kinded.
That would have been in kind.
Well, and Neva, you mentioned like once a year, and it's you know, so you can't give it for somebody's birth. You can't give a gift for somebody's birthday, but you can give for a wedding or an election celebration or you know, some.
And that was the contrast.
And that was up
made,
to $100.
You know,
that was up to
$100. Yeah, what's the difference between a $100 book one time if you are giving it to someone yeah, who just got elected to office versus a $10 paperweight to someone, you know, because you just appreciate the fact that, you know, that they're there and have an open door and are being a good legislator.
And I see this as a matter of free speech. I see it as a matter of your ability to petition the government. I mean, they're trying to give an $18. You go on Amazon, buy it for $18, or you can go to the publisher's website and buy it for $50. You're trying to give this book. I mean, there are a lot of books that I'd love legislators to read. If I thought they'd read them, I'd be handing out books all the time if the Ethics Commission would let me. But I can, you know, there's a difference between giving somebody a book so that they can read it and or hopefully read it and come to view a new perspective around an important issue that they're facing as a legislator. If you're giving people like gold-plated books or something like that, you know, that's a different story. These are just books. And I think that if you're going to restrict the access, even if it's a lobbyist, if it's a citizen or a lobbyist or somebody that's hired a lobbyist, if you're going to restrict their ability to communicate that information in print form to their legislator, it has to be very restricted. It has to be very narrowly tailored. There has to be no less restrictive means to do that. And we see with these other arbitrary rules, like, you know, not birthdays, but anniversary. It's not narrowly tailored.
It's kind of like not a book, but we can give them an annual report that might have cost
yeah,
more than $10
yeah,
for you know, many annual reports that are now created that are done in a way to not only just give the kind of the bottom line for the year, but to educate the reader as to the bigger picture of who they are, what they're all about, and what their vision is for the future. So,
right, but I'm going to kind of take a devil's advocate on this because if they do, they have to put a limit. They have to put a number amount and say, okay, well, $20 then. That will allow this company to have $18. You're gonna have somebody come in and go, I've got a $25 book. I can't give a $25 book.
By the same token, if you disclose what you are doing and you have some limit that may be a much higher limit, but I think at that point, wherever that kind of cap is, mm-hmm, I mean, at least you still have the scrutiny in place. I mean, this is not like these folks don't have to disclose who they've taken to a ball game, who they've
right,
gone out and had a meal with,
given a book
how
to,
much the
yeah,
meal was, what restaurant they were at. I mean, we've got a lot of information that, frankly, I think, you know, sometimes, I mean, we're moving a direction that where's the end going to be?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're moving on the wrong track rather than trying to get all parties to really try to, you know, I think work together. And I think most professionals on both sides, you know, if you really get them into the right atmosphere, I have to believe they're willing to do that. It's just when it goes off the rails, it really goes off the rails.
Well, I think that when this works its way through the federal courts, what we're going to see is that a court will say that disclosure requirements are okay. You know, that's a narrowly tailored mm-hmm, restriction on speech or a condition of political speech. That disclosure, you've got to disclose who bought the book and how much you paid for it and who you gave it
but
to.
But putting a cap on it.
And I think really there's very little disgust or problem with that across the board.
Yeah,
I think we've come to recognize in this day and age that is just part of the way business is conducted.
But you think putting a cap on that?
Yeah, I mean, so, actually. I mean, there's, you know, there's a different, well, I mean, I don't know, I don't even know what that cap would look like. And I think that the cap would need to account for, you know, some books are, you know, $30, $40.
Sure, yeah.
Now, there's a big difference between giving somebody a book about a particular policy issue that they bought at their local, you know, going down to Commonplace Books and buying a book and giving it to their local legislator. That's a lot different than giving somebody a first edition signed copy of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, very different.
I mean,
yeah,
it's like
absolutely.
Or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.